what Roger would call the Platonic realm, what the ancient Hindus or Vedics call Akashic record. Well, there's lots of names for it. Now, purposeful behavior, if you approach them, they move or they do this or that. So they seem to have intelligence and maybe they're conscious. I mean,
yeah.
The way they move, you know, they go here and they go there and there's no vapor trail. So what's their propulsion? We're up in the mountains a little bit and I looked up and there's this round thing. It looked like the moon, except maybe 10 times bigger. I said, "You see that?" She goes, "Yeah, what is that?" I said, "I don't know." You know, with the latest wave of these things, you just can't ignore it anymore. There has to be entanglement in the brain. And I think fundamentally the brain, consciousness at least, is a quantum system embedded in a classical system. The microtubules themselves, they're inside neurons. They're made of proteins called tubulin, these peanut-shaped proteins that self-assemble into microtubules. And there's about a billion tubulins per neuron, and, you know, depending on hundreds, let's say, of microtubules. We need something in biology to quite literally orchestrate these objective reduction events and turn the proto-conscious noise into Beethoven or Brahms or the Beatles or whatever. And that's what the microtubules do. Max Tegmark wrote this infamous paper calculating that the microtubules would decohere in 10 to the minus 13 seconds, way too fast for anything useful biologically. We recalculated using the same formula published in the same journal, and it was more like 10 to the fourth, 10 to the sixth. Our theory, the ORCOR, has more evidence than any other theories. More explanatory power, more connection to biology, and more experimental evidence, validation. They're turning the neuron into a bit, into a number, so that AI can claim to be conscious when we get the same number of bits. Consciousness didn't evolve in biology, that consciousness was there first and prompted the origin of life, but that's another story. The first studies on near-death experiences in medicine came out from Pim van Lommel and Peter Fennec. And they all had pretty much the same description. They all found the same percentage of cases and so forth. We happened to have a full EEG going when the patient died, and they kept it going, and they saw it. They saw the everything go away, and then you got this activity when there was no blood pressure, no heart rate. So that could be the near-death experience, or it could be the soul leaving the body, perhaps. And so they did that study, and the subjects reported later that they were having these vivid hallucinations, vivid experience. They were basically tripping. But the MRI, strangely enough, was cold and dark, as if they were comatose. And there was very little metabolic activity. They were at a loss to explain this. So he said, if you make a measurement here, you get information going backward in time to when the two were together, and then forward. And that's how it happens. Put the chalk down, and that was the end of the meeting. You know, it's like one of those things like, no way, that's crazy. And then it becomes, well, it's obvious. And then it's, we knew it all along.
I'm here today with Dr. Stuart Hameroff, a distinguished anesthesiologist, neuroscientist, and professor emeritus at the University of Arizona. For decades, he has been at the forefront of exploring the enigma of human consciousness. He is best known for co-developing the Orchestrated Objective Reduction Theory, or ORCOR, with Sir Roger Penrose, a groundbreaking hypothesis that seeks to explain consciousness as a quantum phenomenon occurring in microtubules within brain cells. This theory stands at the crossroad of neuroscience, physics, and philosophy, bridging the material and the experiential to shed light on one of the greatest mysteries of our existence. His work has challenged traditional paradigms of how we understand the mind and has inspired new avenues of inquiry into the quantum basis of life and reality itself. So today we'll journey through Dr. Hameroff's insights from the fundamental mechanisms of ORCOR to its profound implications for our understanding of consciousness, reality, and even the nature of the universe. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you, Jay. Great to be here. Good to meet you.
Before we dive into the science, could you just share a bit about your journey? What inspired you to pursue the study of consciousness, and how did this eventually lead to the development of ORCOR with Sir Roger Penrose?
I got interested in consciousness in undergraduate. I was a pre-med. I wanted to go to medical school. I was a chem, physics, math major, but I took a class in philosophy of mind, and I really liked it. I was fascinated by it. And that kind of put the bug in my head in a sense. And plus, it was the late 60s, and we were exploring things back then. And so I just got into what is consciousness. And I went on to medical school and gravitated towards neurology, psychiatry, neurosurgery, things to do with the brain-mind problem. But those lifestyles didn't suit me for various reasons. And I did an internship. I moved to Arizona, did an internship, not knowing exactly what I was going to do, probably neurology, but I stumbled into anesthesiology because my future chairman knew of my interest and said, well, if you want to figure out consciousness, figure out how anesthesia works, because we don't have a clue. And he handed me a paper, and he knew I was interested in microtubules, and he handed me a paper showing anesthesia depolymerized microtubules, although at quite high doses. So the doses in anesthesia probably don't cause your microtubules to fall apart, but they do something to microtubules, or at least they could. That was that was shown. So I went into anesthesiology and worked on modeling microtubules and thinking about anesthesia. And I got the idea, and I got this from my time in medical school looking at mitosis, cancer cells. I did a research in a cancer lab looking at cell division, how the cells divide and pull the chromosomes apart. And everybody else in the lab was fixated on the chromosomes. It was the dawn of the genetic revolution. But for some reason, I fixated on the microtubules, mitotic spindles, who pull the chromosomes apart. And if they didn't do it perfectly, then you could get cancer or maldevelopment. And so the structure looked like a lattice of some sort. I was just learning about computers, switching matrices, Boolean logic and all that. And I thought, well, maybe microtubules are computers. And it was also discovered at that time they were in all different cells, including neurons, were full of them. And so I spent time, I worked with physicists like Steen Rasmussen and Jack Jasinski and others, modeling microtubules as computers or automata. And going around to AI neural net meetings being a pain in the butt, saying your idea of one neuron, one bit, and your brain equivalence at 10 to the 16th ops per second is way, way, way off, because you got to go down a deeper level, and it's more like 10 to the 16th ops per second per neuron, not for the whole brain. So that didn't sit well with AI and neural net people, and they didn't accept that, and told me to get lost a lot. And but one day somebody said, okay, if you're right, how would that explain consciousness? How would that explain, you know, feelings, love, joy, pinkness, all that, which later became known as the hard problem. And I was a bit stunned and taken aback and realized I didn't have a clue. But fortunately, that person suggested I read a book by Roger Penrose, The Emperor's New Mind, which argued for something non-computable, which had to be a quantum effect in the brain, which also would solve the measurement problem. But he didn't know what it was. And he said in the book, he said, I don't know what it could be. And I read that, and having studied microtubules for 20 years at that time, thought to myself, wow, he needs microtubules. That's perfect, what he's looking for. So I wrote him an old-fashioned letter and sent it to him in the mail, and said I was going to be in England and would be happy to visit him, and sent him some papers. And he wrote back and said, yes, please. And so I went to Oxford and met with him. And he asked me about microtubules, and I brought a book I had written about them and a bunch of papers. And first thing he said was, are these simulations or are they real biological? I said, oh, they're definitely biological. They're real. And he was fascinated by the structure, the Fibonacci geometry. And he said he was going to a meeting at Cambridge with philosophers Pat Churchland and Dan Dennett, who are quite skeptical of quantum. And I said, oh, that sounds fun, but I got to go to this other meeting. And I said, good luck. So he said, thank you very much. We shook hands. I said goodbye. And I left, and I thought, wow, that was cool. I met Roger Penrose, a great guy. And I didn't think much of it. But then a couple weeks later, I was returning home from London, and my friend said, hey, I went to this meeting in Cambridge, and Roger Penrose was talking about you and your silly microtubules. And that was a thrill. And soon after, I heard from him, invited me to a conference, and I invited him to the first Tucson conference. And that's how it got started.
Can we unpack ORCoA for the audience? Because I'm not a scientist of any description, although there are some in the crowd. Most of my audience will not be fully versed on these ideas or the kind of language being used, although they have certainly heard enough of me doing my own best to kind of package layman quantum knowledge into weird perspectives on reality and consciousness. But this is obviously a far more refined model being presented by yourself and Sir Roger Penrose. And I get a sense as well that modern science is only really just catching on to the quantum potentials of the human body. So can you just walk people through ORCOR and its implications, and also maybe just give a bit of a layman definition of what microtubules are?
Well, let's start with the biological side. Most people would say that the brain is a complex computer of simple neurons, roughly 100 billion neurons. And to fit with a computer idea of bits one or zero, if you take the Hodgkin-Huxley neuron of integrate and fire, which gets inputs from synapses, integrates them at the membrane to a threshold, and if that threshold is met, the axon fires and it goes to the next layer, and that was termed a bit, or analogous equivalent to a bit. So integrate and fire fit well if it was algorithmic, and each firing could be a bit, and it allowed people to model the brain as a computer. It gave AI hope and ideas that the AI computers could be conscious, because if they're just bits, then if you get complex enough bits, you get consciousness. That was their idea. And, I thought that was BS, because I knew about microtubules and all this information, and I knew that there was something about life itself that we didn't understand. So I thought it was kind of naive and presumptive and arrogant to say, well, a neuron firing is a bit. The microtubules themselves, they're inside neurons. They're made of proteins called tubulin, these peanut-shaped proteins that self-assemble into microtubules. And there's about a billion tubulins per neuron, and, depending on hundreds, let's say, of microtubules. And they'd be switching, let's say, 10 megahertz. So a billion times 10 megahertz is about 10 to the 16th ops per second, which they were saying was for the whole brain. So that was before I met Roger. And then when we tried to turn it into a quantum model, we were immediately faced with the idea that everybody knew, they turned out to be wrong, everybody knew that the brain was too warm, wet, and noisy for delicate quantum effects, because if you want to build a quantum computer in the laboratory, you have to do it at absolute zero temperature to avoid decoherence, vibrations. Roger and I thought, well, biology's had a billion years to, or however long, I guess 3.5 billion to figure it out. And so there must be a mechanism. Although now I've kind of changed my mind and think that consciousness didn't evolve in biology, that consciousness was there first and prompted the origin of life. But that's another story. So we had to deal with the criticism and rebuttals from people. Well, everybody knows it's too warm and noisy. Max Tegmark wrote this infamous paper calculating that the microtubules would decohere in 10 to the minus 13 seconds, way too fast for anything useful biologically. But he made a mistake of 7 orders of magnitude, and it turned out we recalculated using the same formula published in the same journal, and it was more like 10 to the 4th to 10 to the 6th, which we've now shown quantum effects that duration. But the damage was done, and I still hear from people say, well, Tegmark refuted you guys, back in 2001 or 2000. I go, no, we didn't. We refuted that, but nobody read the refutation. And so anyway, that was a big damper. But then in 2006, people began to find quantum effects in photosynthesis in plants and in sunlight.
And in magnetoreception in birds, right?
That too, right. So there was quantum going on, and but it was, people said, yeah, okay, a little tiny quantum, but not the whole brain like you guys want. So yeah, skepticism continued, but in the last, since photosynthesis, in the last 15, whatever, almost 20 years, quantum effects have been shown, all kinds of quantum effects, including what you just said, the bird navigation and following the magnetic field, and many others, including anesthesia, which acts by quantum effects only and is specific for consciousness.
How did they find that out?
Well, the anesthetic gases, and I studied anesthesia right from the beginning of my career in anesthesia, how it worked. And as my future chairman had told me when he was recruiting me, he said, figure out how anesthesia works. We don't know. And the thing about anesthesia, so the anesthesia gases were discovered in the 19th century. And there were a group of gases that they're basically inert. They don't form chemical bonds at all. Because they have a complete outer completed electron outer shell. For example, xenon, the element xenon, one atom, is an anesthetic gas, and it's a completed electron outer shell. And so what happens is, when you have a completed electron outer shell, the electrons aren't free to form charge chemical bonds, but if two come close to each other, these neutral atoms or molecules, the electrons in one, which are kind of in an electron cloud, will repel the electrons in the other, and that forms a dipole. So you have two dipoles, which then attract and oscillate in terahertz. So depending on the mass, so that's infrared, that's or visible even, and so that's pretty fast. And if you have more mass, it slows down. And there was a guy named Herbert Froelich, quantum superconductivity expert, who started looking at the possibility for quantum effects in biology, and came up with what's now known as Froelich coherence, where if you have a lattice of spatially separated, periodically separated entities, each of which could be nonpolar, like these aromatic rings of benzene, the organic chemistry, the basis of all life, they would couple and oscillate coherently and form these giant dipoles, and you can get oscillations depending on the mass from terahertz, but also slower gigahertz, megahertz, and even slower. And that was a great theory, and we kind of used that to justify what we were saying. And then that was actually proven in microtubules by Anirban Bandyopadhyay, my good friend and colleague who works in Japan at the National Institute of Material Sciences. He read our papers proposing quantum effects and started actually studying microtubules with nanotechnology. So he would take a single microtubule, which if you apply a voltage across the ends of it, it's an insulator, so there's no current flow. But if you apply a voltage or an alternating current at various frequencies and sweep the frequencies, you'll find certain frequencies where you get big jumps in the conductivity, in fact, almost superconductive. And they did this in a particular pattern of triplets, so three peaks, and each peak had three peaks. And this repeated in kilohertz, megahertz, gigahertz, and terahertz, exactly the Froelich frequencies. So he basically proved Froelich coherence in microtubules with the addition that the same patterns repeated kind of like a fractal frequency.
Right, right.
And we now think these are what are called time crystals, which explain a lot. So there was that, and we did studies showing quantum effects in microtubules inhibited by anesthesia, and we were part of the Templeton Project, pitting one theory against the other, the adversarial collaborations. And we couldn't work out an adversarial collaboration. We tried with IIT, with Christoph Koch and Giulio Tononi, but they didn't want to look at anything inside the neuron, and they wanted us to do... We proposed a quantum optical experiment showing a quantum effect in microtubule and then giving anesthesia and see if it went away. They said, great, do it inside the brain of a monkey and then put the monkey to sleep. I said, no, you don't understand. This has never been done before. It has to be done on an optical table with balance and no vibration and the monkey would be awake first, so, you know, it'd be very difficult, and we don't do that kind of experiments. And so anyway, that fell through, but Templeton gave us money just to do our experiments, which we did, which worked very well. We did experiments at Princeton in a neutral lab of Greg Scholes, who was a skeptic, actually, with Arad Kalra, who was a postdoc of my colleague, Jack Kaczynski. And we published that, but all the publicity went to the experiments that didn't work, the big bet between Christoph and Chalmers, and they ignored the fact that our experiment had worked. So in any case, more work has come out showing anesthesia works on microtubules. For example, if you give a drug called that stabilizes microtubules, the animals or people in one clinical study actually are resistant and need more anesthesia. So the binding of the microtubules specifically seemed to offset or antagonize the action of anesthesia, as does nuclear spin, but that's another story. So I think this is true. So the other theories of consciousness these days are integrated information theory, which really doesn't specify any biology. It could be anything it's just information without saying what it is. So it's not really biological, I don't think. They point to where in the brain it could happen, but it doesn't show any mechanism, just pure information. So a computer or a thermostat could be conscious according to that theory. And the global neuronal workspace is kind of like a mapping of where in the brain it goes. Okay, that's fine. Higher order thought and then predictive coding. And I think predictive coding is correct. In predictive coding, the brain forms a model of the world, and then incoming sensory input interacts, and anything new or novel is recognized. So if it's not predicted, it pops into consciousness. And I think that's probably right, but it happens at multiple levels, including microtubules.
Hey everyone, this is a very important announcement. I am moving all of my long format content, meaning my full-length interviews, presentations, and productions, over to Rumble. YouTube has refused to remonetize my account despite every effort on my part to fix the issue, and I've now come to the conclusion that I am being purposefully blacklisted and censored. If you want to watch the full-length version of this interview, click the link in the description box or the one pinned to the top of the comment section and check me out on Rumble. Please subscribe. I'm having to rebuild from the ground up on Rumble, which, as you can imagine, is stressful and difficult. So your support means everything. Follow the link to check out the full-length interview and hit the subscribe button to show your support. All of my long-format content, full interviews, will now be exclusively on Rumble. Thank you.
So due to Arnabod's work, we got the idea he did, we picked up on it, that the brain is a hierarchical system. And a lot of people say that, but they start with neurons as the fundamental unit of a one or a zero, and then go up into networks and the networks of networks and then the whole brain. So they go upward and slower as you go larger. But we said, wait a second, do the same thing going inward into the microtubules. So if you start with hertz, then you go into kilohertz, megahertz, gigahertz, terahertz with the same cell-similar patterns. So this hierarchy, scale invariant, because you get the same patterns, goes inward and deeper and faster. And if you apply Roger's idea that eventually this all stems from the Planck scale, the fundamental level of the universe, this could go all the way down, connecting us to the basic level of the universe, which could give you non-locality and quantum effects and had implications for spirituality, a consciousness existing outside the body, and that sort of thing. So I claim, and I'll stand by this, nobody is really specifically challenged this, that our theory, the ORC OR, and I haven't really explained OR yet, but has more evidence than the other theories, and also more explanatory power, more connection to biology, and more experimental evidence validation. And I keep saying that, and people, it annoys the heck out of everybody, but nobody's challenged it and said, no, here's evidence for this theory or that theory, because it doesn't exist.
Now, but before we jump into the OR section, one thing I just wanted to rewind back on is, what would you chalk up the dismissal to? Is it just dogma and adhering to the models in science that have made sense so far, or is it something else? Would you consider this to just kind of be institutional blindness to an unconventional model, regardless of the fact that positive results were made?
Well, if I were a conspiracy theorist, I'd say that AI is trying to squash us and funding and supporting all the what I call cartoon neuron theories, because the idea of the neuron in these other theories, well, not IIT, they don't even have neurons necessarily, it's all information, is just looking at the neuron at the membrane level and at one frequency band, like basically EEG, up to 100 hertz max, and algorithmic, when the inputs hit a threshold, the integrated threshold, the neuron fires and gives you a bit. However, recordings from neurons in awake animals show that it's not algorithmic, that the threshold changes from spike to spike. So there's some other factor, and it has to come from inside, because if it came from the outside, you see it in the membrane potential. So they're not algorithmic. So, but AI would like us to believe, or maybe they do believe, that neurons are no different from bits. And I think this is extremely naive. It's a tremendous insult to neuron. We don't yet know what life is. And I think life actually requires quantum entanglement, quantum coherence. But they're turning the neuron into a bit, into a number, so that AI can claim to be conscious when we get the same number of bits. So I think that, and I think in the last few years with the LLMs and great advances in AI, I have to admit, but not consciousness. And they can fake it, but and even if they can, fool people with the Turing test, it doesn't really. It's not consciousness necessarily.
Would you hold space for the potential for, let's say, a hypothetical quantum AI system that's now using qubits rather than bits? Is there a potential for a novel consciousness expression within that?
Well, it wouldn't be novel necessarily. I think consciousness is consciousness. And I think it's the same same basic mechanism, microtubules, not only in us, but in all animals and even plants. All animals and plants have microtubules. And and as I said, I think consciousness started first and was probably the spark of life by through pleasure. These molecules arrange themselves and all of a sudden have a conscious moment, and then they would optimize that by how they arrange to optimize pleasure. And that's how life started, in my opinion, and that of my colleague Dante Loretta. And we're working on the origin of life now with the idea that consciousness might have come first, and really it explains a lot. That's what I think anyway.
Well, it makes me definitely consider the whole generator versus receiver models for how the brain-body interface is able to manifest a sense of self. If, for example, quantum processes in the body are responsible for the foundations of what gives rise to human consciousness, as you put in OrcoR, and you've kind of answered this already, does quantum processing have to be restricted to the system, restricted to the developments of the brain? Or could it be that consciousness itself is the unified field, is part of the quantum vacuum, and is innately present at a primordial level, which basically seems to be what you're suggesting?
Well, it's a little bit of both. And let me back up, because you had asked me and I didn't answer it. Could there be consciousness in a quantum system? And
right.
That's actually, and the answer is yes. And I think that's actually happening. And Anirban, whom I mentioned earlier, is actually directing a big project in India, funded by the Indian government, to build a self-organizing organic quantum computer that kind of grows itself, and you have to interface with it. That's the tricky part, but and self-organizing by the same type of quantum interactions that occurs in biology between these aromatic rings, which are key, I've heard that other groups, industrial groups, Microsoft and Google and others are maybe following the same path. But Anirban is a pioneer with this. I think, he's I've always said he's decades ahead of others in this. And I think eventually we'll have room temperature, self-organizing organic quantum computers that you don't need a giant freezer or zero temperature, that they could be on your, I don't know what they'll look like eventually, but they can happen at warm temperature by organic molecules the same way that we do.
Right. That's kind of the joke of it. We'll spend all this time building the quantum organic bio room temperature superconductive computer, just have it turn around and say, hey, you're already this thing.
Yeah.
You can already do all of this.
Yeah, but this is something you can build on it in a lab, or it can build it itself. So how that turns out, I don't know. Do we have to worry about those things becoming conscious and taking over? I don't know. The way I look at it is that the world is divided into two realms. The macroscopic everyday world that we're in, of fairly large things, everything's in one place, particles interacting by the laws of nature faithfully, Newton's laws, Maxwell's equation, et cetera, predictable. However, if you get small enough, roughly, and we don't know how small is small, but there's some cutoff below which, roughly the size of atoms or molecules, below which you have a different set of laws governing behavior of these particles. And they're the quantum laws in which particles can be in superposition at multiple places at the same time. So instead of here, the same particle can be here and here and here and here, like a wave. And yet, when you make a measurement on a system like this, all the different possibilities of superposition collapse to one particular one. So you see one definite state. And this is called the collapse of the wave function, or the measurement problem in quantum mechanics. If you make a measurement, why does that happen? So how? So The first idea from the pioneers of quantum physics, well, Bohr kind of ignored it. It said it was in the measurement, but Wigner and von Neumann said that the conscious observation per se causes the collapse of the wave function. And that was a pragmatic solution so that they could go on and do quantum mechanics and develop all the wonders we have today, including computers and TVs and whatnot. So that was a good thing. But it didn't really explain everything, because it didn't explain what consciousness was, nor how a conscious being looking at a entity over here could cause it to collapse. Nor did it explain superposition. And it was kind of telepathy, actually. There's no direct contact. You look at it and it collapses. But that's what seemed to happen. So the other possible explanations was all decoherence, that any local interaction with the environment would get rid of the quantum. But it didn't really get rid of it. It just kind of covered it in the noise. So that wasn't really a solution. And then the multiple worlds came along, many worlds, Everett in 57, that each possibility, there was no collapse, each possibility went on to form its own universe. We have these many worlds. And Roger came along with kind of the opposite of the conscious observer causing collapse. He says collapse occurs on its own, and that causes consciousness. But before he did that, he had to explain what superposition is. How do you explain how a thing can be in multiple places at the same time? Which is a good question. Everybody else started with that and then tried to rationalize or explain it. And he first addressed that question, which I don't think anybody else had or has still to this day. And to do that, he brought in general relativity, in which Einstein predicted that there was this underlying space-time metric that curved with mass, or was curved by mass, or curvature caused mass, depending on how you looked at it. So, for example, the sun, being a rather massive object, would bend light from behind it around the sun and could be seen here on Earth. That was his prediction. And in 1919, Arthur Eddington did the experiment from the top of a mountain during an eclipse, and sure enough saw stars that were known to be behind the sun, that he could see them off to the side of the sun. And that proved curvature, Einstein's general relativity. Eddington got his Nobel Prize. Einstein already had his, but it was for large objects. So Roger came along and he applied it to very tiny things. So the sun makes big curvature, but an atom or a proton or an electron, we have a little tiny curvature. And then you could see, well, if a particle was here and had a curvature here, but also here with curvature here, you have two opposing curvatures. So you have a separation in space-time geometry. The universe at its most basic level kind of bifurcates. And to imagine this, yet it's easier to think of space-time as two dimensions, one of space, one of time. So you can picture this. And Roger had these really cool drawings. And so what you get then, a superposition, is space-time separating. And I always thought that if these separated curvatures continued, each would form its own universe, and you have many worlds. So I think if I were in the many worlds, I'd grab onto this idea and say, the separations occur in superposition and continue. But Roger said that the separations were unstable, and after a time t equals h bar over e sub g, they would collapse. So the time was inversely related to the amount of superposition. So if you have a very small superposition, small e sub g, you'd have a very long time. So a single particle, a proton or something, could be in superposition but take 1,000 years before it collapsed, if it was isolated from everything else. Something very large would collapse very soon. And so biology is somewhere in between. And so where you have the collapses, and when we applied this to microtubules in the brain, we wanted collapse times to be relevant to neurobiological effects. For example, EEG and gamma synchrony EEG, which at that time and still more or less is the best neural correlate of consciousness. So gamma synchrony is like 40 hertz, for example. So 40 hertz is 20, T is 25 milliseconds. So if you plug T equals 25 milliseconds, And we know H bar is a concept. The E sub G turned out to be fairly small, not too many turbulence. In fact, I think it was 20,000, something like that. And, you know, that's less than one neuron, really. So we thought, well, maybe only a few in each neuron, so it could involve a lot of neurons, because we realized we need a fair number of neurons involved in consciousness. But anyway, that was the first idea. But then, yeah, and 25 milliseconds is also a long time to avoid decoherence, because we still have to worry about that. Eventually, we came around. So we published our first papers on this in 1996. Tegmark started, he started the criticism in 2000, 2001. But then the photosynthesis came along and validated to some extent our ideas. And then 2014, we revised our theory and said, well, you know, and this was actually due to, at least as I remember, a suggestion by Paola Zizi, who was an Italian cosmologist, who said, well, why do you have to have these fairly long times T? Why not much, much faster? Because then you avoid decoherence and so forth. You'd need more entangled tubulins. But at least it would be reasonable to avoid decoherence for a shorter time. And we decided that she was probably right. And so we changed it so that T could be, well, by then, Anirban had shown quantum, these coherences of microtubules in kilohertz, megahertz, gigahertz, and terahertz. So we settled on, as an example, 10 megahertz, because that seems to work the best for other reasons. So if the time T was, if these were happening at 10 megahertz, time T would be 10 to the minus 7 seconds, which is short enough to avoid decoherence, but would involve a lot of turbulence throughout the whole brain. So we needed an entanglement across the whole brain, which turns out to be possible, and we needed a lot of turbulence short time. But the problem was our brains, at least in consciousness and cognition, seem to be a lot slower than 10 megahertz. Visual epochs are probably 100 milliseconds or so. Evoked potentials are maybe a few hundred milliseconds. So how did we get from 10 megahertz down to 10 hertz, for example, or 40 hertz? And I remember discussing with Roger on the phone, and he said, well, maybe there's negative resonance. And I said, well, what's negative resonance? And he said, well, it's like interference, like beats in music. And so maybe the 10 megahertz, some of them are slightly off, and they'll interfere, and you'll get slower beats, which will percolate from megahertz to kilohertz to hertz, and we get the EEG. So in our 2014 paper, we hypothesized that the EEG is actually due to beat frequencies of much faster vibrations in microtubules. And EEG is still a mystery in neuroscience. It's very useful, but nobody understands, you know, how it all fits together, what the gamma has to do with the alpha, beta, and that sort of thing. And you would think that the brain should be one system and has some one unified output or some unified mechanism. So you needed an entanglement. So we proposed that as not only a mechanism for consciousness, but explaining the EEG and also anesthesia in our 2014 paper. So we still got criticized for other reasons and so forth, a lot for spurious, irrelevant reasons, actually. But I think the 10 megahertz idea is right, because Anirban, I told you he discovered all these coherent oscillations of the microtubules, which can now be measured from the scalp. So with a special probe, you can measure what he calls the DDG, the dodecanogram, because there's 12 orders of magnitude buried in the EEG. And with a single probe, you can measure megahertz. And if you set the spectrum analyzer to between 6 and 26 megahertz, you see the three peaks right from the scalp of a single probe. And Anirban just finished a big experiment in India in patients going under anesthesia where they measured this. I promise not to divulge the results, but it's the paper submitted, and we'll see what happens. But it's very promising, and I think it's going to be revolutionary, actually.
Well, you know, I'm of the opinion that there are innate capacities within the human body that have severely atrophied over time, potentially due to the consequences of our choices collectively, especially within so-called modern and civilized society, where, you know, we are polluted with, as you said, noise from the cellular level to the psychological level. And the idea that any delicately perturbed macro quantum effects within the human toolkit would be readily present and easily evidenced in a society that is honestly as sick and disconnected from natural energies as we are, I would think is quite absurd. And yet these things do appear, which would say to me that it is a natural innate capacity of human biology, but something has happened to us where this is atrophied. Follow the link to check out the full-length interview and hit the subscribe button to show your support. All of my long-format content, full interviews, will now be exclusively on Rumble. Thank you.